Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring some of the lesser heard stories in tech and venture. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to founders, investors, and ecosystem operators to bring you insights from the roads less traveled. Hey, and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. In this podcast, we talk about tech, venture, and all things ecosystem related with operators, investors, and others in and around the tech ecosystem in the UK and beyond. Today, I'm really, really pleased to welcome Tariq El-Sheikh to the show. Tariq is a multiply exited founder currently operating in stealth. He's a good friend and a wonderful guy. So welcome to the show, Tariq.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Arish. I'm super excited to be here.
Excellent. So one of the things I wanted to dive right in on is just to understand a little bit about your story, because you've had a bit of an interesting time. You've come out of banking into entrepreneurship and technology. So could you just talk our listeners through kind of that journey and what triggered that move from, I guess, you know, corporate to tech and startup?
Sure. Well, first, let me just thank you for having me here. And more importantly, like not introing me as a serial entrepreneur, which is a term I really hate. But yeah, like, you know, one of my pet peeves is like, you know, people saying the term serial entrepreneur, because when has the term serial ever been attached to anything positive, right? If you think about it. But, you know, to kind of give you my story in a nutshell, I studied molecular biochemistry at uni at Oxford. So I'm a nerd. As I graduated, I realized that I loved science and the method and the scientific way of thinking, but maybe I just didn't belong in a lab. It was too lonely. So then I like to joke and I say I sold my soul, and then I joined the now very infamous house of Lehman Brothers, but absolutely loved my time there. And if I was going to maybe sum up my 20s in my early career, it was investment banking for a good 6 years, consultancy and private equity, and M&A for 4 years after that. So, you know, a decade in the world of consulting and finance. And I think what that told me is two things. I think my consulting experience taught me how to use frameworks and analyze Pareto, those kind of skill sets, which are pretty useful as an entrepreneur. Banking just teaches you process, right? It just forces you to teach how to execute time and time again, just get stuff done. And also teaches the language of finance, how to look at accounting, how to look at balance sheet, what a convertible debt is. And then M&A and private equity, like, just teach you how to operate. And yet, despite that, though, you know, I remember when I launched my very first venture at the age of 29, I thought I knew how to run a company. And I didn't know shit about running a company, because, you know, I think when you come from that world, you learn a lot. But I think in the world of venture, and whether it's technology or just even a traditional business, it's about people. It's about operations. It's dirty. And having to manage, you know, I realized that, you know, most humans are not alpha minus males, females, Harvard, Oxford graduates, right? So that was a shocking wake up call. But what pushed me into entrepreneurship is certainly not my choice, right? You know, I grew up in a traditional Middle Eastern, Eastern European family where, you know, if you weren't a doctor or a dentist or an architect, you're a failure, right? So, you know, I trod the right path. I did the right things. I went to the right university and I got a high-flying job. And it was only until, you know, Ben Bernanke made that wonderful call on September 15th, 2008, when I went down with a ship. And that was kind of like my, oh, it's not that safe being in a 152-year-old, God knows how many billion worth institution. And that was kind of like my wake-up call and what pushed me into being an entrepreneur. And I like to joke, working for the best idiot that I know, and that's myself. And that's really when I kind of started into the world of technology and venture.
So you're at Lehman Brothers, right? The ship sinks. You go down with the ship. What's the thought process then in terms of what do I do next? Where do I try and do that next? What are my skill sets suited for? Because, okay, biochemistry, banking, consultancy, all of those three things are great. And they're obviously very, very interesting skill sets, which do give you some kind of generalist skill sets, but they're also very, very specific industries, right? Like, so how did you take that leap from I'm a banker to, you know, I'm going to set up my own business? What was the thing that actually triggered that beyond the collapse of Lehman itself?
So kind of like the skill set and why I ventured into what I did, I kind of stumbled on it, if I'm going to be honest. They always say the best ideas or the first ventures you should come from a space that you know. And one of the first companies I ever tried was actually a company that made suits, custom-made suits. And we sold them online, right? Now, I thought I knew suits because I used to get my suits made in the Middle East, in Asia, and I'd fly back. And I was based in London at the time. And my boss would look at me and say, am I overpaying you? And I go, what? And he'd say, like, you know, that costs, you know, £5,000 in Savile Row. And I'd be like, that's 500 dirhams in Burj Dubai. Like, what's your problem? And that's kind of when I realized that there was a supply demand mismatch of, like, we are very, in Asia, we're very used to custom making our clothes, and that's a secret to looking good. Whereas in the West, the sons and daughters of tailors have become lawyers, bankers, what have you. So it becomes much more expensive. And I was like, oh, what if we try to use technology to bridge that gap with e-commerce? And we just kind of, I went along with that with my two American partners. And the Americans, you know, they're like, they kind of wear those horrific pajama suits. And they also went through that aha moment. So anyway, we started kind of building that company out. Extremely painful, you know, direct to consumer, horrific CAC. The lifetime value was amazing, though, just because of the customer behavior as we discovered that, you know, scale the team. Operations initially were in Dubai, and then we moved to Hong Kong and mainland China, and we sold mostly into the United States. So that was an amazing experience. And I think part of that first kernel comes from the fact that I came from that world, right? I used to wear suits, as did my partners. But in terms of like managing 50 fashionistas, that was like a whole new world and a whole new experience, right? The operations and stuff, and none of that stuff, you know, that I did in the past, I think really prepares you for it. You learn a lot by that exposure. You know, I kind of like to say that every company is led to my next company, and the learnings from the last one has made my next one even better.
So this is one of the questions I wanted to ask, right? So horrific, I can imagine, horrific operational kind of setup, having to have, you know, manage tailors, fashionistas, surely, you know, potentially all over the kind of globe, as it were, and then, you know, logistics of getting suits out on time. And this is back in 2009, 2010, presumably, right? So we didn't have quite the same system.
So yeah, ideation was kind of like 2010, and we kind of launched formally 2011, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah. So we didn't have necessarily the infrastructure that we have in place now, even from a technology perspective, right? So like some of those, hooking all of those processes up operationally must have been quite tough. So you said the learnings from the last inform the next. What would you say was like the biggest thing that you wish you'd known going into that business, and like the biggest learning that came out of it?
Oh, okay. So two, I've got two direct ones that I can share with you and your audience. So the first one was kind of like, just in regards to when you do this a couple of times, you just become much more experienced and you can spot the potholes. And that translates itself into effectively your return on investment, your capital, right? You know, you can anticipate problems, you can hire better, all these small cumulative right decisions that just add up over time, and you end up burning less cash or getting a better valuation, etc. So with, just to give you an idea, with Not Standard, you know, full disclosure, we raised a seed of like $650,000, right? Which in today's terms, you know, with inflation was one hell of a lot of, like, that's a big seed for the time, right? Massive seed. Also, like, from the, we raised it from the US and the MENA region and London. So it was pretty big. We burnt through that in no time. Like, we almost collapsed the company because we kind of, in hindsight, thought we knew what we were doing. And did some pretty stupid things when you're, you know, 29, 30, 31, et cetera. How did I translate that to my next startup? So after kind of leaving that company called Not Standard, I started another company called Athen, which changed its name to be called Benipple, Benefits People, which is effectively an HR SaaS product that was a play on HR and health insurance tech. And just to give you a like for like comparison, we seeded that company, just the five founders, and about $100,000 worth of seed investment. And we sold that company in a year, right? So extremely much more proficient. Like, we were just so much smarter. We had tools, frameworks, customer discovery, how we constructed the founding team, the dynamic equity, everything else, you know, just meant that our probability of failure was better, because you're always failing, right? You're trying to unfail yourself. So that was one big lesson. You know, and I think it shows, right, in kind of the tenor of a founder. Like, I'm generalizing here. You meet some founders who are like 24 and they're just rock stars, but they are the extreme exception. They're not the norm. The norm is, you know, between the ages of 39 to 45, right? Statistically, that's been shown. Then the second thing is on the concept of earnouts and dynamic equity and having what I call really shitty, uncomfortable conversations really early on. Right. So one thing I learned from Not Standard is really getting together with your co-founders and laying everything on the table. Like, what do you want to do? Do you want to build a lifestyle business? Do you want to IPO? What are your drivers? Because you're getting married, right? And if you don't have that uncomfortable conversation about, do we raise our kids Christian, Muslim, or Hindu, this will come and bite you in the ass further down the line. And I thought we were smart by avoiding that. And we didn't have dynamic equity. We didn't have any of that smart stuff. And ultimately, like, that led to a massive dislocation and alignment of incentives that ultimately really resulted in me saying, fuck this, I'm out, right? And I think ultimately to the detriment of the company when we all thought the strategy was different. Now, how did that translate into my next venture? We structured it traditionally. We had those upfront conversations. We talked about responsibilities, what would happen if things go well, what would happen if things go wrong. And we had dynamic equity. And I think because of that, we experienced in that company, a lot of people don't know this, but we experienced what I think is one of probably the biggest shocks a founding team could experience, which is the death of one of the founders during the early stages. And in Benapol, you know, one of the guys, really amazing guy, you know, won't go into it, but long story short, wrong place, wrong time. He was in the US, you know, it was one of those like life altering moments where you get a call from your advisor telling you that one of your partners is dead, right? And it's only because the whole thing was structured properly that we as individuals and as a company did the right thing, right? By him and his family and everything else. And it was hard enough keeping it together afterwards, but that was just, you know, it was set up right and we could withstand that shock, right? And kind of move on to a great, you know, opportunity for many of us. So I always say at every stage is kind of like a lesson learned to take you to the next one.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's definitely one of the things that I talk about a lot is the need to structure correctly right from the outset. And it seems like anathema for most founders because they like to work with a bit of chaos, a bit of uncertainty, and processes are for kind of, you know, stick in the mud kind of businesses. But, you know, startups are not meant to be startups. They're meant to be businesses. So ultimately, you do need to structure them like businesses. For our listeners, when Tarek's talking about dynamic equity, he's talking about vesting shares for founders, reverse vesting, etc. So basically, you know, there's a lot of horror stories out there in startup world where, you know, you have a founding team, which, you know, you're great mates, you get started on working on something, and one of them 3 months in says, actually, this isn't for me, but you've left him with him or her with 30% equity in the business, even though they've spent 3 or 4 months in there, right? And that can be really disheartening then to the remaining founder or founding team, because you're lumped with this ridiculous kind of situation on your cap table. So those were your first two businesses, right? Now, the second business, you know, so that second business, Benapol's, like, talk me through, how does one achieve a 12-month exit? How does that even happen?
So I'll tell you something, you know, there's been enough studies, and I think Bill Gross has got the most famous one when he analyzed like his top performers from the studio and his VC and his worst performers. And the two biggest indicators of success are one, timing, just dumb luck, which you can't control. And then two, like whether you had the right product market fit and there was use for your product, which sounds like common sense. So I'd say, like, first and foremost, like every founder that's gone through this is, we got lucky, right? You know, you make your own luck, you work really hard, but we also got lucky. And I think we were extremely kind of structured in how we pursued the Benapol HR opportunity. It was also good timing. It was the same time as Zenefits that was in the US. And that just came out of Y-com, and it just exploded. And the business model kind of resonated with our business model. And we also scaled. And yet, despite all these challenges that we had, you know, it was a very attractive business model to many of the insurance brokers in the region. And one of them was like, we'll just buy you, right? And then you kind of have to make that choice of like, can I build this myself with my team right now? Or is this the best outcome for everybody? And I think at the time, you know, given the challenges and the fact that it's very hard to get a broker's license and things like that, like, we collectively said, you know, let's do this. They ended up retaining, you know, some of us anyway to kind of work out our equity. And I got a chance to kind of build a B2B sales team. So that was fun. But then you also realize that, you know, you're an employee now, and what took you minutes to determine in a room with your partners now takes you a quarter, and you get angry and frustrated. So yeah, I ended up kind of saying, great, thanks, I'm done. And I kind of left to start my next three companies after that.
That's amazing. I do agree, you know, luck plays a huge part in startup life. Generally, I think serendipity
you know, making sure that you meet the right people, that you're having the right conversations. Some of those things, you know, are outside of your control. So just want to move on slightly from kind of the startup learnings. But one of the things I'm really keen to explore and have spoken to a couple of others about is the challenges you may have faced raising capital. And you've raised capital from different geographies at different stages. And you're a, you know, to your point, Middle Eastern, Eastern European descent. What were the challenges for you, like trying to raise capital in the market? And, you know, even today, what are the challenges that you see?
Oh, gosh, that's, oh my, like we could spend 5 hours unpacking that, couldn't we, right? And it's such a loaded question, especially when you kind of ask someone like me. So I've raised capital from institutional investors in the United States, in Israel, in Europe, in the Middle East, from angels and super angels, as well as micro VCs. And look, it's challenging for an entrepreneur wherever you are. I would say, so what have I noticed? And maybe as patterns is probably the best way to kind of share on my most recent experiences. So look, the reality is, and you kind of touched on one of these two things, that there is a certain stigma associated with, you know, not looking like a, you know, white middle-class male. You know, I've been on board meetings, I've heard VCs say like too many Middle Eastern names in that deck. I've had calls where the VCs were questioning one of my founders and her capabilities. And I really wonder whether they would have questioned it if she wasn't a female or not. So like my advice to anyone who just wants to go into entrepreneurship is just like go into this eyes wide open. Like it's really, really hard. And, you know, if you are, I don't want to say ethnic minority, but, you know, if you are of different descent, then you just have to accept the fact that you're going to have to work harder in order to prove yourself. That, unfortunately, is just something, you know, that's embedded, ingrained in the ecosystem. And I think if we pretend that that's not there, then I think we're being disingenuous. Saying that, however, I do think it's changing. I mean, there are now some VCs that have, you know, picked up the fact that actually, you know, minority founder-led companies, mixed companies, female-led companies, even public companies that have women on their boards statistically perform better, right? From an EV point of view, from a valuation point of view, which is an investment opportunity in and of itself, right? So they say, we only seek those, right, that do that. So I think it's getting better. But I think if you really look at the numbers, like available capital to deploy versus access to stuff like that, we still have a long, long, long way to go. But it certainly has improved tremendously over the last 10 years. Zoom and COVID have actually helped, because what it's done is it's flattened the investment world so that home bias of American VCs, which I think are the most forward-looking and the most VCs, right? For lack of a better, they're not money managers, I'll put it that way. They've kind of woken up to the fact that European, Asian, Middle Eastern companies are so much cheaper than, you know, the equivalent American counterpart, and the founders can be just as good, and the markets might be nuanced and unique and different, but, you know, hey, I'd rather invest in that from an ROI point of view. So I think actually, you know, on that front, it's been really, really positive. But I'd say that the risk appetite spectrum is highest in the United States and San Francisco, and we're in the world of venture, right? Like you have to be able to swallow risk, and it kind of decreases exponentially the more east you go, right? Or maybe there are other drivers that influence that. I think that's a fair assessment or description.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And in terms of kind of your actual fundraising journey itself, like what are the things, what were the challenges you faced as an entrepreneur, right? Rather, so putting aside some of the kind of more demographic and social kind of issues that you just discussed, what were the challenges as an entrepreneur? What were the things that you wish you got into some of these meetings with at your fingertips, or the knowledge that you should have had coming into those meetings, or even, you know, having then raised money? Are there lessons that you learned having raised from institutions versus super angels versus, you know, the US versus elsewhere?
Oh my God, man. Like I think that would be endless as well. We'd spend a day unpacking that too. Gosh, I've seen everything from like loan sharks to that wanted like 90% of your company and made you think or feel like you're doing a favor. And if you're a first-time founder, you might fall for that. I've seen like people say, if I invest in you, how quickly do I get my money back? And I'm like, I think you mean real estate, right? You're in the wrong room. You know, I've heard even sophisticated investors, you know, institutional say like, oh, if you go away and do this, then I will invest in you. And I'm like, if I did that, I wouldn't need your money. which is a typical response. And I do say that to them. Sometimes it upsets them. Sometimes they like the honesty. I don't know. But I would say the one unwavering pattern or rule that I picked up is don't compromise in your capital stack. It's really, really important. And part of most business models, particularly technology-enabled business models or anything that has a significant J-curve or burn. So it's a dynamic thing. And whether you're taking in the early stages what I call love money or angel money that's a bit more understanding and willing to take more risk, or whether it's more institutional, a bit more structured further down the line, you as a founder have to be extremely educated to be able to speak the language. Just one of the founders has to learn this language and has to be good at it. If nobody knows what convertible means or ASA or SAFE, like someone needs to know it. It's key to your business. So that's one insight number one. One insight number two is it's kind of like common sense. If you go to a founder, would you take a bad customer? Would you take the money from a bad customer? And most founders have good business acumen and sense to basically say, nope, I'd give them their money back and say, thank you very much. Have a good day. Because we all know a bad customer can kill your time, your customer service, your motivation. And you actually want to go and do business with and customers who are like you. Well, guess what? It's the same thing with investors. You want to take money from people who believe in your vision, who think like you, who have your brand values, your ethics, your integrity, et cetera, et cetera. So don't compromise on that. I see a lot of founders never compromising on the customer point of view, and they realize its importance. But then, because they're so desperate for money, they compromise on that. And that always comes back and bites you in the ass, always.
So that leads to kind of another question I had for you, right? Because there's a lot of... there's always this tension between raise money versus bootstrap, right? Where do you fall along those lines? Because I think that's a really interesting one to understand, especially at a time where we're moving into cycles of revenue-based financing, so non-dilutive financing structures, you know, which are being offered by companies like Clearco and Capchase and others like them. Pipe, you know, by Harry Hirst is one that has come out recently as being really, really taking the world by storm a little bit. So where do you fall on that line? Like, if you could do it all again, would you try and bootstrap or would you take the money, or does it depend?
I think it kind of depends on your, you know, the problem that you're trying to solve, right? And in each one is, because each one's unique, you got to kind of tailor your capital stack, your needs, in the same way that you're going to tailor your human resources needs as you scale and grow, right? So if you're doing something in deep tech or biotechnology where your go-to-market or break-even rate is just years ahead, then naturally you only have limited, not limited, but certain pools of resources that have to understand your business and your risk. And that's what you do, right? So maybe you tend to get more diluted than normal. If you're a non-technology high scale business, you should not touch venture money, right? Because venture money is kerosene, right? So if you have a restaurant and you're doing well, what the hell are you doing pitching to a VC, right? Just because you've made up some tech enablement garbage, right? Like, no, you're traditional. Scale nicely, like just follow the normal routes. I think it's in between where it gets muddy and it's part science and part art. What I would say on that front is, so the typical classical rules of financing is avoid using equity because it's your most expensive cost of capital, right? Followed by mezzanine and venture debt, followed by senior debt. And then finally, you know, some of the other structures that you can bring in place. Now, I'm not a fan of using the word bootstrapping. What I'm a fan of is using the word revenues, right? So I would say from the lowest cost of capital and for making sure you're actually building something useful, your first port of call should be to make money, right? So as soon as you build something useful, you know, that should be validated by someone giving up their currency, which is a cash representation, tangible representation of their time, right? Their work. And they appreciate that and there's value and they give it to you, whether it's a business or a person. So you should be driving to be make not profits, but just money day one and looking to grow that, right? Now, there are some business models and strategies where it makes perfect sense to grow slowly from revenues or classic bootstrapping, as it were, or seeking other traditional forms of revenue-based financing or whatever and just kind of growing it slow. So things like e-commerce, fragmented markets, if you're building a brand in the long run, yeah, do that, right? No need to raise venture. Venture is like rocket fuel. If you launch something like Facebook and there can only be one platform to take it all, right? Like whatever, one thing to take it all. And kind of like capital is probably one of the few hurdles, then raise a lot at some crazy valuation and run to the next level and run to the next level and run to the next level. So it really kind of depends. It is opportunity product specific. It's business model specific. And then it's also your skill set specific too in making those choices. It's much more complex than what people tend to kind of talk about, right? People tend to talk in brush strokes, broad ones.
Yeah, so nuance is unfortunately no longer a thing. I think, you know, Twitter killed nuance a while ago. So what are the traits as a founder that you think have been really valuable for you to I mean, like you said, 5 or 6 startups now, effectively, right? So what do you think is the biggest trait that you have that has allowed you to go in again and again and again? And as we saw earlier, you have a young family. So entrepreneurship, you know, typically people say, you know, don't launch a business if you've got family, if you've got children, because, you know, your time is going to get sucked by the business. So yeah, what would be your advice to people around that? What are the traits that have helped you be a founder time and time again? Because that takes a huge amount of resilience in and of itself.
I think that's the key word right there. Like you just mentioned it. So there are some, I would say, basic DNA traits that good founders tend to have. Like we tend to be intensely curious about anything. And I see that when I'm learning a new industry, like my dad's turned this into a joke. He's like, what are you selling, suits now? Or, oh, HR, what do you know about HR? And then, oh, a medical website and pregnancy apps. And then, you know, food and dark stores. And he's like, he just gives up, right? Like he gave up. But every time people always say like, oh, Tarek, sometimes you just turn into an annoying 5-year-old and just ask why and how. And so I think intense curiosity to learn all the time is a key one. Sometimes if you're doing something particularly unique, then being a specialist or having a lot of years of experience in that or studied it in his PhD is also really helpful. It gives you an insight if you're doing something, you know, focused. But I would say the other, oh, yeah. So different people disguise this in different ways. Some people call this passion. Some people call it, you know, energy or whatever you call it and, you know, intensity. And most people would kind of tack that onto me. I would just say stupid. Or at least short memory, for sure. Because every time I start a company, I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, it's hard. It's so hard, right? It's like going to war. You're in the trenches with your founders and everybody else. Like, that's the closest thing. It's like having a child and raising a child. So never do it solo, right? And yet, you know, we'll do it again. We'll forget all about the pain. Maybe like giving birth, right? Otherwise, I'm glad women have that. Otherwise, the human race would have died a long time ago. But yeah, like, we just constantly forget. I think we have a passion for just fixing problems. We're natural problem solvers, right? We're optimistic by our nature. But the most important trait, I think, I always say I can teach and I do teach entrepreneurship, and you can empower entrepreneurs with every kind of framework and model and really important life experience. And I think they appreciate that a lot. At least that's the feedback they give me. But the one thing I always tell them I can't teach you is grit, like that resilience, that ability to like get knocked down and get right back up again. You know, you get an email from an investor as you're pitching another VC who says, I'm sorry, I'm not going to invest in you. You know, you're having to let someone go whilst an hour later pitching someone you really need to join your company that might save your company. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's really challenging. It's almost schizophrenic. And I think that's what makes this so hard, right? And I tell people, embrace the chaos and get ready. But you've got to have that resilience mentally and physically, and that's grit. So I always say you can teach, I really think you can teach 90, 95% of entrepreneurship, but that grit, you can't teach that. I don't think so.
We're going to talk about what you do at NYU and kind of the courses that you teach on entrepreneurship, because I actually fall on the other side of the fence there, where I don't think much of entrepreneurship can be taught. I think it's a learned skill whilst doing rather than a learned skill whilst learning. We'll touch on that in a bit. But one of the things that I also wanted to kind of ask you about as a founder and having now kind of, you know, you talked about it earlier, pattern spotting and pattern matching. What is the one thing, what is the small kind of cluster of things that you now look at as a founder in your business day in, day out? You know, revenue obviously is like quite an easy kind of obvious metric, as it were. But what are the things that you track that give you a really good leading indicator about the health of your business and where you're going?
Oh, that's a really good question. And it's a really tough one. It is very nuanced and I think very unique to every business model and every problem that you're trying to solve in your company. You know, sometimes it's revenues, if you're revenue-based. Most of the time, it should be sales and revenues, in my opinion, your one North Star. I always say every company should have one North Star, right? Whether you're 10 people or 100 people, if I'm in the elevator and I'm the CEO and I turn around to a junior and say, what's our North Star, like he or she should know it and track it, right? And most of the time, you're right, that is some kind of measure of value, right? Sales, eyeballs, you know, monthly active users, whatever it is. Whatever you guys decide is your measure of value. But the way I think about it, the pattern that I've spotted is if you think about everybody in a company as a professional team, right? That's really what you want to build as you get bigger and better and recruit people that match your culture. If you think about them almost like, if you remember your physics, like a magnitude and a vector and the arrows, you kind of, the hardest thing as CEO is making sure that all the vectors are aligned. Because when the team is doing what they've been brought in to do and they're all aligned, like they just do, it's magic. They just do, they solve anything together. And it's almost like they don't need you, right? Like your point is to make sure that they're all pointed in the right direction and just to move shit and stuff out of their way so that they can do their jobs. That would be the biggest pattern that I would give, you know, as advice to any founder, like just enable your people as you scale, as you work it out.
That's super interesting. This is now the third conversation I think I've had on this podcast where someone has kind of said something very similar. You know, Hussein Kanji from Hoxton talked about it in terms, he doesn't look at the founder, he looks at the team that they're able to build around them. And I think, you know, that's exactly what you're describing. Like, I think great founders build great teams. They attract the best people. They have a magnetic force that allows them to kind of attract, you know, the best in talent around them. And yeah, I think, you know, health of a venture is very, very much dependent on its people. If you have a toxic kind of team, then you're going to have a dysfunctional team. If you have a dysfunctional team, you're going to have a dysfunctional business, right?
Yes. You mentioned something that I thought was quite interesting, and I might challenge you on that, in that you kind of said, can entrepreneurship be taught? So having spent some time in Africa and Asia and India, like I can tell you, man, and you know this, they're all entrepreneurs. They are all hustlers, problem solvers, you know, out of the box thinkers, like, you know, you don't do, you don't eat, right? So I actually think it's in our nature. I really think it's human nature. And I think those genes get activated from actually a harsh environment and stress and opportunities. And I think it's in the world of abundance and safety and laziness that gene gets repressed. So I actually think we're all born entrepreneurs, and it just gets beaten out of us typically over time or school or whatever. And then the other one is, I think given some of the magnitude of the problems that we have, you know, the environment, healthcare, education, like it just doesn't work. And it's getting worse and worse with time, right? COVID did nothing but just stress the system and highlight exactly what we thought we knew. COVID did nothing new. I call it the great accelerant. It just brought fast forward the future like by 5 years. So I really think the solution to this is entrepreneurship in our schools, how we employ, how we raise capital, how we solve the problems of the world, science, food, agri-tech, technology. And it's only by enabling more humans to become entrepreneurs, to skill them up, that we can do that. And I've validated this thesis, right? Like I gave myself a personal challenge of creating 100 entrepreneurs 2 years ago, and I've already done 120. So now I've pushed that number up to 500 in 3 years' time. And I'm onto a business model where I think I can do that. So that's my North Star, right?
So yeah, I think when I talk about not being able to teach entrepreneurship, I think there is an element to entrepreneurship that is based around the ability to see and seek risk, but equally to assess risk and take risk at the right level. I think people kind of have this assumption that entrepreneurs are just like inherent risk takers and that's all they do and blindly do it. And I think that's completely incorrect. I think like the greatest entrepreneurs are able to understand and assess risk. They're not risk averse, but they're also not, like, you know, they're not stupid, right?
We're 100% calculated risk takers. That's the right way to describe it.
Exactly, right? And I think that is something that comes with experience of looking and understanding what's going on and being able to kind of set things side by side and be able to analyze kind of what the outcomes are, right? Always think about everything in terms of scenarios, right? Good, bad, ugly, and what the outcomes are likely to be. So when you teach entrepreneurship, like how do you teach your students how to assess risk? How do you teach students how to seize an opportunity? Like those are things that are, in my mind, kind of not teachable maybe. Like you can teach, to your point, like how do you set up your cap table? How do you hire people maybe? How do you kind of build a good culture? If you can at least create playbooks for, if not teach, right? So people can be guided, but there are sort of inherent traits within entrepreneurs, I think, that are less easy to teach. Maybe I'm just wrong and maybe no one ever taught me.
Okay, cool. No, well, in that case, I'll for sure share a couple of data points with you, and then maybe hopefully leave you a little bit kind of excited and inspired, at least, that there is hope for us as a human race. Because if I'm wrong, then I really hope Musk is right and we can all start to colonize the world, otherwise we're screwed. So I've been fortunate enough the last couple of years as well to have advised, worked with, architected, you know, some of the most awesome university entrepreneurship courses, NYU being one of them you mentioned, as well as work with some accelerators and incubators all around the world. One of which was with a very good friend of mine, Ryan Bethencourt, when they first founded IndieBio, which is now the largest biotech accelerator in the world and super successful. They've launched Finless Foods, Memphis, you name it, like companies that are IPOing now, right, in the biotech space. And our thesis there was, could you take scientists and turn them into entrepreneurs, right? Like, you don't get the super risk averse, very structured, critical thinkers and make them calculated risk takers, right? And want to try exactly these traits that you just described. Now, Ryan and I both, we kind of cheated because we both came from that world. Like, Ryan did genetics at Cambridge and I did, you know, biochemistry at Oxford. So we knew we could do it because we did it, right? So I would say the first thing, a lot of the work that I do with incubators, accelerators, even venture studios, corporates, and universities is really around a mind shift within the various individuals. And sometimes, like, it's a big delta of mind shift. Like, the scientist needs to realize that they can sell, they can do a market sizing exercise, they can take capital risk, they can pitch in front of other investors. So it's kind of giving them those opportunities to get out and do it. And other times, you know, it's about more tailored, like an MBA program, younger crowd. They've got all the skill sets. They're hungry. They're ready to do it. But it's letting them realize that it's okay to be a failure. And in fact, I always tell them, your default rate, your great idea, it has no customers, no money, nothing. Its default state is failure. So get out of the building and do it. And just forcing them to go out in a structured way, they learn, right? They're forced to do it, right? You create that environment that forces them to learn grit and to think about, would I hire this person and how do I sell and do this stuff? So I know from experience that many of these traits that you're describing can be taught. A lot of it is very experiential. Like you're saying, it's easy to teach finance on a cap table and stuff like that. And a little bit of practice, you know, whatever online course, spreadsheet, you're good, fine. But how do you teach someone to sell? Like, you kick them out the door and say, you go sell the product, right? You get out of the building, as Steve Blank likes to say. And I can definitively tell you that a lot of this stuff can be taught. It needs to be tailored based on the student. It's a form of education if you think about it, right? And education starts with a shifting of the mind and the frameworks. But again, that grit, that resilience, that ability to get, you know, go get up again, that optimism, that's the only thing you can't teach, because that is a, you know, inherent structural psychological feature. But everything else, trust me, you can teach it.
Yeah, it's super interesting. One of the conversations we had with the guest, you know, we talked about the fact that the education system in general, we're talking about like kind of K-12 here, is not fit for purpose. It, you know, industrial age education, where it was all about, okay, how do you go out and become an employee? What we need to be sort of taking our kids through is a journey where they learn how they can add value in the world, right? And part of that adding value is like, how do you move from employee to employer? But how do you move from, you know, someone who is a rent seeker almost to actually creating value and enabling, you know, more value to be created, which I guess is really ultimately the reason people choose entrepreneurship. You know, some may say it's because they think they're going to make $1 billion. But I think for the most part, entrepreneurs become entrepreneurs because, to your earlier point, they have an itch they want to scratch. There's something that they just maniacally want to resolve. They want to solve a problem that they can see in the world, right? And if they can solve that problem, then it makes the world a better place. And I think that's kind of the way I would see entrepreneurship as also being teachable, maybe. So I'm willing to be persuaded. I'm also open to learning always. So I just wanted to move on to a couple of things just as we wrap up as well. So I know you do a lot of work and you mentioned some time in Africa, etc. So it'd be great to understand, you know, the work on the social enterprise side of things that you do, because I think, you know, it's actually something that's very close to me. I've worked with a number of ventures and sit on, you know, as a trustee on a charity, but I worked with a number of ventures ventures that are in the kind of impact space. And social entrepreneurship is something we talk about. Access to capital for social entrepreneurs is, again, a huge problem someone needs to solve, but, you know, maybe we won't do that on this podcast. But yeah, take us through kind of your learnings from there and the kind of differences between a venture and a social enterprise, and kind of how that's why you do what you've done and what it is that you've done and what that brings to your life, I guess.
So I think fundamentally, people try and put things into boxes, right? Or frameworks to help them define it. And probably if you were to Google this or do some research, the difference between a typical venture, the social venture, is that by its company, corporate, mem and arts, and its DNA, the social venture doesn't just have a for-profit KPI. It'll also have a social venture related KPI, right? So it might be number of lives saved or number of secondary shoes donated to children in Africa or something like that. So it's not just profit, it's profit and, you know, whatever the theory of change dictates it is, right? The impact that you're trying to have.
Profit with purpose, I guess, is exactly what a lot of people talk
exactly
about.
Exactly. Which I think, you know, typically when I talk to people, and I also work with accelerators in this space, a lot of people tend to have that disconnected in their mind. And I think it comes from the idea that it's hard to make money and do good at the same time. And I don't believe in that thesis. I challenge it very, very strongly. And I think this younger, newer generation embraces that by default. You know, my generation X and beyond that, you know, questionable. And I think we're responsible for some of the headaches that are currently existing. But I think, you know, the younger generations, Gen Z, what have you, like, they're on it, man. Like, they will make a brand choice depending on whether they think it's sustainable or ethical, whatever, which is amazing. They're basically long-term thinkers, right? So I'd say historically, there was a disconnect between profit and doing good, and people didn't think you could do both. I actually think in the long run, you can, and the two are not disconnected. I've been really lucky enough to be working with UK charity institution, an organization called Reach Children UK. We were working with our sister companies in Uganda and Kenya, you know, as well as some of the other partners as well. And we do a variety of things. One of the ones that really excites me personally is what we've termed Grandma's Gardens right now, where we're effectively empowering and structuring a social venture that allows these grandmas to work the lands and grow pineapples specifically, right? I think you're from that part of the world, right? Originally, like, you grew up there, your parents grew up there, and you know, like, the grandmas are like the backbone of the family, right? And they've inherited a lot of orphan children because of AIDS and war and stuff like that. So by targeting them, by targeting women, you know, we're kind of having that double. We can empower them, allow them to run a social venture, make money, and then feed that back into the system as opposed to rely on handouts. And that's really exciting to me.
Yeah, I think that's an incredible gift to give back as well. And yes, I mean, like, I'm from Kenya originally. And, you know, I often reflect on the fact that it doesn't matter, you know, where you are in the world, but especially in sort of developing economies, they are just so singularly sort of focused on the matriarchy, right? Like, it is the mothers and the grandmothers that make the society work. And I saw this in Papua New Guinea when I was living out there, etc. So yeah, no, I completely get why that's important. So Tariq, we're going to wrap up now, but I just thought, what are some final thoughts you might want to leave listeners as an educator, as an entrepreneur, as someone who is out to do good in the world? You know, what are the things that you would like, you know, our listeners to take away from you today?
Yeah, parting advice. Oh my God, so much to do. I would say entrepreneurship is really hard. Don't do it unless you've got a really strong driver. But it's so much reward. It's so amazingly rewarding. Like, it's allowed me to never miss a school recital of my children and really not sacrifice that. Although it's still hard work. And, you know, guess what? You're going to be working really, really hard as well and staying up late. But it's certainly a personal challenge and growth path that I would highly recommend most people try in their lifetime at least once. And then two, I think it solves our biggest problems. So, you know, if you do hate the education system, don't whine about it. Like, try and fix it, whether you're an intrapreneur within the education or healthcare system, or whether you're outside it. Like, don't whine, fix it. And then the last one is, like, just be kind and pay it forward, right? And, you know, help each other out and, you know, help with those connections, because it might be a small act of kindness and nothing from your side, but it'll change people's lives, it'll ripple through. So yeah, be entrepreneurial if you can, but be going to Wise Open, you know, have an impact, don't whine, and be kind. That would be my advice.
I think you could take that advice to the bank. So Tariq, look, with that, I want to say thank you so much. Where can our listeners find you online?
You can find me on LinkedIn. Generally, I'm quite reachable, tariq.elshaikh@gmail.com or LinkedIn. I tend to respond if it's something super interesting or interests are aligned in terms of creating entrepreneurs, which is my North Star. That's probably the best way to find me.
Amazing. Tariq is currently working in stealth on a venture. I hope to be able to talk to him about it in the future. But for now, Tariq, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been great speaking.
Thank you for having me, man. I've really enjoyed being here today.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. As always, we'd love to get your feedback on our conversations, your thoughts, as well as topics or guests you'd love to hear from. Drop us a line on social media or via one of the links in the show notes. But for now, be well, and I hope to catch you on the next episode of Nothing Ventured. I mean, what have you got to lose, right?